Hello, and you're very welcome to Adapt Radio. My name is Dr. Claire O'Connell, and today we'll be talking about AI and European security and resilience.
From the Adapt Centre at Trinity College, this is Adapt Radio, presenting groundbreaking innovations one conversation at a time.
Europe cannot rely on external platforms to police our information ecosystems. In this same way, we cannot expect others to defend our democratic integrity. And we must build our own capabilities.
So Ireland has the presidency of the Council of the European Union in the latter half of 2026. And on June 30th, which was the eve of starting that presidency, we had the launch of a new centre at Trinity College Dublin, which is looking at digital security and societal resilience. Now, astute listeners will know we've covered this a bit recently. They will join the dots to a recent episode where we spoke with Hitesh and Maria Grazia, who are leading this new Trinity Centre for Digital Security and Societal Resilience. But this was the big launch, and the timing couldn't have been better because digital security and AI will be major themes of Ireland's presidency. And the event was a full house at Trinity's Longroom Hub with many ambassadors and politicians present. Also there was Olivia Waters, who is Head of Impact and Growth Strategy and Adapt. And Olivia, you are involved in the new centre too. And there was a great buzz in the room, wasn't it, at the launch?
Hi, Claire. Yeah, no, it was a great launch, I have to say. We had over 20 European ambassadors in the room.
Yeah.
It was packed to the brim. I mean, you know, but it shows, I think, a real interest in this area of digital security and societal resilience. You know, it's a European priority. You know, I think Ireland taking the baton from what Cyprus have done during their presidency and taking it into our presidency, it shows that this is a national priority as well. That came out in the speakers on the day.
It did, yeah.
And, you know, and I think the launch of this new centre is also a real success story for Trinity. I mean, being able to have the expertise that spans the full breadth of digital security and societal resilience and what that needs, you know, everywhere from the technical side of things right through to the economic and the business side, and then into, you know, the human factors and how people engage with these technologies and the risks that are around that. Having all of that under one roof.
Yes, in this centre.
Yeah, that this is now an opportunity, I think, for Ireland to make a real impact on an international stage.
And one of the big themes that came out, certainly during the launch and all the talks, was that digital resilience is not just about the technology. Obviously, there's technology involved, but there's so much else around it. And that's where this centre needs to draw in research from so many different quarters and disciplines so that people work together on that problem. And, you know, there was such a crackle of excitement in the room. On the one hand, you had a lot of people who were sort of from the Cyprus side, who are finishing the presidency, passing the baton literally to the people on the Irish side, and they were excited to be receiving that baton. And we heard a lot of speeches. We heard from Neil Richmond, Minister. We heard from Nisha O'Carroll, Cypriot Ambassador to Ireland, Ambassador Louis Telemaku. I'm sure I've said his name wrong. I'm sorry. And of course, we heard from Professor Hitesh Tiwari, who is the director of the new centre as well. Did anything stand out to you from those initial speakers or those speakers who were from the sort of ambassadorial and political side, Olivia?
Yeah, I mean, I think each of them brought a different perspective to the conversation. So Neil Richmond, you know, he was very eloquent in how he showed that, you know, digital sits at the heart of Irish government priorities for our presidency around competitiveness and values in society. And, you know, he emphasized, which was very important for us, that the importance of the research expertise and how this new centre can play an important role in connecting the ecosystem, informing debate, and, you know, bringing people together on sometimes difficult issues. And then the ambassador, so Ambassador Telemaku from Cyprus.
I did get his name wrong, sorry.
So again, you know, he drew similarities between Ireland and Cyprus, two island nations sitting on the flanks of Europe.
Yes.
But, you know, critical infrastructure, how digital connectivity, how this resilience and these aspects are critical to how our nations function and how we remain as part of Europe and what we can give back to Europe as part of that. And, you know, Cyprus did so much around this during their presidency. They prioritized the digital agenda. And, you know, their aim was to help create a Europe, I guess, that was more capable and more able to respond to the likes of, you know, things that we're seeing. We see it in the newspapers, we see it in the media, cyber threats, cyber interference, you know, and the protection, as I said, of critical infrastructure. And then, you know, finally, then Nisha Karul, so he's a local TD, but he's also the chair of the Oireachtas Committee on AI. And he outlined Ireland's efforts, you know, to govern and protect the digital space. And Ireland's doing a lot in this space as well. You know, we have a new AI office that's going to open in the next, I think in August, if I'm not mistaken, the new digital and AI strategy that was launched. There's a commitment around a new cybersecurity research center of excellence. And then, you know, the thing that we're also involved in, and many of the academics for our new Center for Digital Security and Societal Resilience are part of, is the new RIN AI National Research Center. Mm-hmm. Trinity is the lead as part of that. And, you know, so he mentioned all of these things. So Ireland's doing a lot in this space to develop and really foster a digital understanding and security and resilience across society.
Great. One of the things I really liked about Nisha O'Carroll's speech was how much he started at Osgailge as well. He was at Kind Osgailge. I was like, oh, great. And then he switched to English and said, okay, probably more people in the room will understand that.
Official language.
Given the amount
EU.
Of international people who are in the room.
But it's an official language
of the EU. So it was brilliant to hear it being so well represented as well. So well done, Nisha. All of these speeches kind of set the scene or surrounded the keynote from Dr. Anna Kokidis Prokopiou, and I'm sure I've gotten that name wrong as well. I'm terribly sorry. Anna is former Minister of Justice and Public Order in the Republic of Cyprus and is now a Peace Fellow at Jackson School of Global Affairs at Yale University. What stood out to me was how she framed the power of digital technologies and AI in historical context. She mentioned things like the Book of Kells, which was just across the way in Trinity, the Gutenberg Bible, and even the 1916 proclamation sort of painted that broader picture of change that we're going through. What did you think, Olivia?
Exactly that. I thought she was really eloquent in her keynote, considered her thoughts, informed by her different backgrounds from academia, but also as part of a public official in Cyprus, and how these two things can no longer be looked at in isolation. And when I say these two things, I mean, you know, cyber and digital security and the societal side. They're linked, they're connected. There is a cyber physical past that happens, you know, things that happen in the digital sphere bubble over into our real life and our real world. And that is seen around, you know, democratic security, in, you know, the hybrid threats that happen. And we saw it with the HSC attack and how that, you know, can impact and cost a lot of money and potentially, you know, threaten people's lives as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I thought she really framed how these two areas are now linked and connected and need to be seen as one holistic kind of challenge.
Okay, well, let's listen to the speech. Here is Dr. Anna Kokidis Prokopiou speaking at the Trinity Long Room Hub.
Distinguished guests, colleagues, friends, esteemed hosts here at Trinity College Dublin. Let me first thank you for the great honour to deliver this speech today, celebrating the launch of Trinity's Centre for Digital Security and Societal Resilience. Standing inside the Trinity Long Room Hub, a space explicitly designed to host the most urgent intellectual debates of our era. Difference. We gather here at a moment of strategic convergence, as we've already heard. Tomorrow, the rotating presidency of the Council of the European Union officially travels from Nicosia to Dublin. This handover is strengthened by a profound, unique, legal, and historical connection between the two cities, to capitals that anchor the outer flanks of our union. To begin with, in a European Union predominantly shaped by continental civil law traditions, Cyprus and Ireland stand apart. We share a similar legal system, the common law tradition. This shared legal DNA acts as a platform of strong cooperation between our two countries that, as a former Minister of Justice, I feel obliged to refer to. But our connection runs deeper and shared legal text. It is forged in shared historical scars. Yes, the EU presidency transition does mark a physical shift from the easternmost maritime anchor of a union to its western gateway. Yes, both borders shape the front lines of European security architecture in fragile and turbulent times. Yet, above all, Cyprus and Ireland are two island nations still scarred by internal division and the power dynamics of having stronger and bigger neighbors. Circumstance has thus forced upon us an intuitive understanding of geopolitics. Experience has taught us that divisions are not merely lines on a geographical map. In the same way, cleavages are resisted when resilience becomes endogenous to society through linkages and social cohesion. Divisions can also be molded and take a life of their own when extrapolated by formed collective consciousness, by strong beliefs, by ideas and ideals. Cyprus and Ireland, we are both speaking from an existential baseline when we point out that societal resilience is never a passive state. It is deliberate. It is active. Its building up is a highly political and conscious choice. We know exactly how fragile peace is, how vulnerable a divided society can be to external manipulation, and how vital it is to protect the internal democratic bonds of our communities. The daunting security question is, of course, how safe are our communities? How safe is democracy? And by extension, how secure is the European Union, whose very essence, its very foundation, lies in the upholding of democratic values? Under our presidency motto, Cyprus spent the last 6 months forging a path towards creating the structure and legal defenses Europe needs to secure its future. However, our slogan, an autonomous union open to the world, carries a profound internal mandate. Before we can ever look outwards, before we can stand as an open anchor to the world, we must first look and secure inwards. If our interior foundations are fractured, openness becomes an invitation to vulnerability. And that is precisely why resilience is so vitally important. Strategic autonomy cannot be projected onto the global stage unless it is first cultivated within our own borders, our own networks, and our own communities. True readiness is built from the inside out. Now, the baton passes to Ireland. Historic day today. Among Ireland's presidency priorities, as we've heard, are responsible innovation in terms of competitiveness, societal trust as an important part of values, and institutional resilience as part and parcel of the security pillar. These come handy to the immediate demands the European Union is faced with. Yet, one cannot forget that as a premier global technology hub, Dublin sits at the very epicenter of Europe's digital economy. And this unique positioning comes with immense responsibility for the incoming Irish presidency. Responsibility that recognizes that leadership is not merely measured by the speed of deployment or market capitalization, but also by how AI and technology in general add value to the protection of citizen rights, the enhancement of trustworthy institutions, and the underpinning of democratic values. This is an urgent task, as the fabric of public confidence in democratic structures across the European Union and beyond seems to be fraying. Europe should strive to be a pioneer in human-centered digital architecture, because human-centered values is what Europe stands for. And this is what our concept of digital security should first and foremost be all about. That is, ensuring that any kind of technological advancement strengthens our democratic structures and doesn't indirectly or even directly tear them down. If Europe cannot do it, no one else can. And Ireland is now at its helm. Dear friends, later today we'll have the privilege of touring Trinity's historical library and hopefully view the Book of Kells, a 9th century manuscript containing the four Gospels, part and parcel of our shared European history. A manuscript which came about at an era of profound fragmentation, a time which can be described as Dark Ages. It was back then that Irish monks sat in isolated scriptoriums, meticulously preserving knowledge, culture, and what in their eyes reflected the light, reflected the truth. Lux veritas, as we would say at Yale. In no doubt, the Book of Kells even today represents the ultimate victory of active cultural preservation of values or foundations in times of change and political chaos, reminding us that if ideas can be written down, they cannot be killed. And as one walks through the long room of the library, one stands before another replaceable cornerstone of Irish identity, a part of Irish identity over and above religion, an original surviving copy of the 1916 Proclamation of the Irish Republic, a defined reminder of the power of the human spirit, the engine of revolution. Similarly, as a Yale Peace Fellow, I cannot help noticing that one catches a comparable glimpse of monuments of human history when one walks through Yale's Beinecke's Library in New Haven. There you have a copy of the Gutenberg Bible, dating back to 1456. And then a little bit further down rests an original printing of the American Declaration of Independence of 1776, exhibited next to the invaluable original working manuscripts of Alexis de Tocqueville's early 19th century Democracy in America. Consider the Gutenberg Bible. It represents the pinnacle of the cutting-edge information technology of its time. Johann Gutenberg's immovable type was a profound systemic disruption to order, which completely decentralized the monopoly on information and began to democratize knowledge, symbolically picking up where the monks of the Book of Kells left off and speeding up the process of the handwritten preservation and the spreading of ideas. It was now possible that texts could be printed and disseminated to those who could read, but not necessarily write, as let us remember, writing skills were often purposefully withheld from the masses as a form of control of human agency. Through the ages, humanity has crossed many thresholds and has suffered many disruptions. History shows us that disruption, in this case, technological disruption, is what often makes political transformation possible. Look at the American Declaration of Independence. It marked the beginning of a sweeping political revolution, a seismic shift in human governance that would have been completely impossible, perhaps without the printing press. Because before leaders could stand on a podium and rally a crowd, before generals could lead any army, the philosophical foundations to change had to be laid. Political revolutions require cognitive preparation. And it was the mass-produced pamphlets of Thomas Paine and other radical essays that explained, amplified, and normalized revolutionary ideas in the mind of ordinary citizens. Just to put things into perspective, Paine's Common Sense was published in January 1776, quickly became a bestseller, selling 120,000 copies, reaching an estimated 20% of the colonial population, making it the most widely circulated American publication of its time. And in July 1776, Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence had to be rushed to John Dunlop's print shop overnight, so 200 physical broadsides could be immediately and widely dispatched to unify Washington's troops. And in that same exact spirit, in 1916, in Liberty Hall here in Dublin, rebels rushed to do the same, so that the proclamation could be read out on Easter Monday. Famously faced with such a severe shortage of physical lead type that they had to print the proclamation in two separate halves because they literally ran out of the letter E. Why is this all relevant? Because information warfare precedes and shapes any battle. Despite the primitive rush, the logistics, these printed sheets achieved something miraculous. They overthrew the psychological authority of global empire and created new collective consciousness necessary before new physical sovereign borders could exist. And I am asking, isn't the printing press a comparable disruption to the one we're living through today with the spread of social media? As we are today wary of the use of algorithms, wasn't the printing press also feared back then for very much the same reasons, as it unleashed forces that could not be easily controlled by the established order of things? Are we not also watching aghast a new technology scale information faster than our social fabric can process? And could perhaps good things also come out of such disruption? Today, the digital space acts as the same exact psychological staging ground of the past, but it operates at an exponential, hyper-accelerated rate, amplifying ideas, radicalizing public opinion, coordinating social movements in seconds rather than months, often completely detached from any editorial filter or factual baseline. And the lesson learned should be that we cannot turn the clock back. We cannot stop progress, but we can champion instead responsible progress to counter structural volatility. We should also look to the positive while trying to curtail the negative. We should also look to how digital tools have, for example, made citizen polling, plebiscites, online voting, the gathering of citizen assemblies, the voicing of opinions, mass campaigns for honorable causes, the unveiling of corruption, and even environmental protection and movements towards peace more possible. Nonetheless, while not trying to demonize technology, we should simultaneously be careful of its pitfalls. Reverting to my favorite place as a historian, that of the library, and reviewing Alexis de Tocqueville's original handwritten lines at Yale, his most vital conclusion echoes across the centuries to confront us directly. Tocqueville observes that free democracies do not simply fall to advancing external armies. They collapse from within when the citizens lose a shared sense of truth and civic trust. As we stand here today, we must strip away all diplomatic euphemisms, I'm sorry, my dear diplomats, and confront an uncomfortable reality. If we now turn our attention to the negatives of technological advancement, a war is being waged against democracy, our democracy, this very moment. It is not a war localized to a conventional battlefield, nor is it a conflict heralded by formal declarations. It is a quiet, asymmetric, and continuous assault. Our collective security has been deeply infiltrated in the digital space, with immense cascading effects that ripple through our elections, our financial markets, and our social and institutional trust. All around us, the moral and ethical scaffolding of international order seems to be collapsing. And so our European values are there being chipped away. States have no hesitation in utilizing their sharp power capabilities to infiltrate and control hearts and minds. This infiltration forces us to completely reevaluate our definitions of security. Security is no longer exclusively about hard borders of conventional army lines. It is about cognitive defense, the active structural safeguarding of our citizens' mind. When fear replaces fact, our democratic institutions fall into doubt and widespread disrepute. When public trust dissolves, our internal defense shatters without a single soldier even firing a shot. To withstand the civilizational pressure, Europe cannot simply rely on firewalls and regulatory audits, but must return to the protection of the core, that is, the recreation of the feelings of the polis, the sense of inclusion and belonging of all citizens to the body politic. Unless citizens can trust and understand the added value of their institutions, the democratic institutions, they will not rise to their defense. And unless these institutions first and foremost deliver what is expected of them, they will not be defended by citizens. True societal resilience therefore demands that no one is left behind. Dear friends, under these circumstances, it is imperative that we rid ourselves of the dangerous illusion that digital security belongs solely to the virtual world, and it was something that it was already said today. For Europe, the lesson is clear. Resilience is about building flexible, legally compliant, and radically transparent institutions that can withstand systemic shocks without fracturing. And this brings us to the core purpose of today's gathering. Why must we celebrate the launch of Trinity's new Center for Digital Security and Societal Resilience? Because in the same way that Europe cannot depend on foreign technology providers to protect our data, Europe cannot rely on external platforms to police our information ecosystems. In this same way, we cannot expect others to defend our democratic integrity. And we must build our own capabilities. And in my mind, this is what this center is trying to do. By bridging the technological and the practical with the deep, the reflective, and the ethical rigor of academia. In my mind, especially in perilous times, academia is responsible to go public, to provide and disseminate the necessary intellectual tools that shape our furniture of mind as citizens, to have those difficult conversations which politicians sometimes avoid because of political cost. I have a feeling that drawing on centuries-long tradition of Trinity College, this is exactly what will be taking place here with exceptional vigor. My sincere wishes to the Center for Digital Security and Societal Resilience. Thank you for making part of this launch.
And that was Dr. Anna Koukidis-Prokopiou speaking at the Trinity Long Room Hub, where she emphasized something that was a motif, I think, and I mentioned it at the start, you know, but again, this idea of digital security is not just a technological issue. It goes far, far beyond that. I suppose after that keynote, there was a short panel discussion, which was ably chaired by Professor Patrick Gagan, who is the director of the Long Room Hub. And on that panel, we heard Richard Brown, who is the director of the National Cybersecurity Centre, Dr. Maria Grazia Porchetta, who is the deputy director of this new Trinity Centre for Digital Security and Societal Resilience. And of course, Maria Grazia was a previous podcast guest on here too. And we heard from Dr. Johnny Ryan, who directs Enforce in the Irish Centre for Civil Liberties. The chat was short, but it was punchy. We heard a lot about the need for protecting infrastructure, the kinds of digital threats that pose a serious risk, and also a very interesting challenge to Ireland's position as well. Olivia, what are your thoughts on what we're about to hear?
I thought this was a great panel discussion. I love the different perspectives that came through as part of it. And I think these are conversations that we need to have and that the centre is able to pull together and to sit there and convene different voices around challenges that have different perspectives. And I think, you know, Johnny's perspective from the civil liberties and the regulation side, and Richard's from the cyber threat, and then Maria Grazia from the governance side of things, they need to come together. They can't be seen in isolation. I enjoyed it. I thought it was great. And I look forward to us running other punchy panel discussions as part of the centre in the future.
Yes, academically punchy.
Academically punchy.
Okay, let's dive in.
And Maria Grazia, I wanted to begin with a question for you. And really, I love this bringing together of it's digital security, but there's a second part to the centre. It's also societal resilience. So what's the ambition there with bringing together the digital security side, and why resilience?
Thank you very much, Patrick. And thank you to the audience and the brilliant talks that we had today. I think integrating and lots of things that we've heard from our speakers in my response. What's important to remember is that resilience has always been part and parcel of cybersecurity. It's been there since the 2013 policy. And it acknowledges the fact that living in a digital society means to accept a degree of risk, just like flying. If we wanted to have 100% safety in the skies, we couldn't really fly. Resilience means to bounce back. And it's connected to the idea of identifying critical infrastructure. For instance, undersea cables, as we heard, energy supplies, you know, artificial intelligence connected to core societal functions, all points that are in the program for presidency for Ireland for the coming semester. From the perspective of society, resilience, societal resilience really means that society is not broken when a challenge arises, but is actually able to bounce back. And what we have in mind today, what we are thinking about is disinformation, is AI, is geopolitical upheaval. So we want society to be able to withstand these challenges and hopefully come back stronger. And the research that we hope to be doing in the center hopes to develop solutions that are, you know, at the service of societal resilience. So we hope to provide digital security solutions that are at the center of societal resilience, which means a democratic society, a plural society, a society that is proud of its values and civic trust, as we heard from Anna Kukinas-Procopio. So yeah, this is where societal resilience comes in.
Brilliant. A question for Johnny. John, first of all, say I love the fact that you're on the panel because it shows that the center wants a different point of view. It wants to challenge and interrogate things. It's not just proposing one approach, but a multiplicity of approaches. I read your piece in The Guardian this morning, and the headline was "Ireland is Big Tech's Lapdog." Now, you may not have chosen the title, but you know, some hard-hitting comments there where you say that Ireland is so compromised when it comes to tech that perhaps for some of the meetings during the presidency, it should recuse itself. So what should we be alert to? What should we be concerned about over this 6 months?
Patrick, thank you. I think it's right and proper that an academic conversation should be able to address some of the tricky conversations that in this country we're not good at. That title is not one I invented. Those words came out of the lips of a Meta executive. That was Sarah Wynne-Williams' language from a meeting she had with Enda Kenny back in 2013. So what isn't being done? Well, in the Democracy Shield, for example, and in the lead up to the Democracy Shield, we've had a lot of conversation about the impact of recommender algorithms on societal resilience. And you're right that the printing press was consequential. What it didn't do was select poison and place it into the perfect individual ear. That is clearly a very dangerous and harmful technology. There's no longer really much scope for argument about that among scholars, unless I stand to be corrected. And under law, as we currently have it, those systems should be off by default. They shouldn't be on. And the enforcement of that law should be happening here in this particular city across the entire union. So just as a first step, if we were serious in designing a menu of actions we would take for resilience, the first action we would take is that the Irish Data Protection Commission would enforce Article 9 and 8, I would say, of the GDPR, and recommender systems would be off by default on all platforms where they're using intimate information about people. Now, my criticism is that it took a question from one of our parliamentarians to the head of our Data Protection Commission in January, I think, or February, in the AI committee. It took a question that took him by surprise for us to finally learn that in 10 years since the GDPR was enacted, our authority, which must act before any other authorities in Europe can act together, our authority is yet to complete a single inquiry, an EU-wide inquiry, into Google. It is yet to complete a single inquiry, not for better or worse, any inquiry. So I don't think we are at the first step, really, with the tools we already have. And at this event in October, we will probably hear about the need for more legislation. Every business is telling us stop legislating, and the smarter ones are saying start enforcing.
Richard, as director of the National Cybersecurity Center, I think you have responsibility for leading the operations, including managing the national response to cybersecurity incidents of all kinds. I wonder, what would you see as the risks, the threats? How big are all of these? Because we're hearing some of them there.
Sure. I mean, first of all, thank you for the invite. And I mean, to welcome the formation of this center. Resilience is one of the, we have four directors in the NCSC. Resilience is the second, but founded 10 years ago now. So the state has been working on building resilience across digital systems and society for that long, at least. The 2015 strategy makes this case very clearly. What are the main risks and threats? Well, I suppose the first thing to keep in mind is we are vulnerable to exactly the same types of risks and threats as every other European democracy. So in no particular order, the first and most pressing issue, because it's the most damaging right now, is ransomware and fraud. We see regularly ransomware cases which damage large and small entities, public sector, private sector, businesses, you name it. Everybody gets affected by this. And that sector is changing quite dramatically. I'll come back to that. The second thing is espionage. So there are a number of very active state and non-state actors, actors who are associated with states in espionage space, which are extremely active on public sector bodies, on research institutions like this one, particularly in pharma and related areas. And there's obviously a huge amount of intellectual activity here, a huge amount of intellectual property. And that makes Ireland a particular target for this kind of activity. Doesn't help that we don't have a history of thinking about these things in that way. The last two issues, destructive issues. So for example, our colleagues in Ukraine, who we worked with for many years now, continually see attempts to destroy or damage critical infrastructure and services using cybersecurity means. It happens here as well. Much more limited, but it does happen. And obviously there's a link between espionage and destructive activity, because if you're in to collect data, it's very easy to go one step further and start breaking things and turning things off. And the last piece, which is very pertinent in the presidency, is hacktivism. Hacktivism is obviously a portmanteau of hacker activist. And one of the most active fields in European cybersecurity operationally now is dealing with distributed denial of service attacks from very active, often Russian language speaking groups seeking to drive certain political or public motivations in that kind of domain. One thing just to add to this really quickly, AI is changing all of these dramatically. In the ransomware space, the market for ransomware, as in the market between the different types of groups in Russia, is changing dramatically thanks to the use of AI. It's getting cheaper and easier to conduct ransomware attacks thanks to AI, and that's changing the market internally within the groups. State-led actors are openly, widely using this now, not for the simple stuff like phishing. That's always going to work anyway. I wouldn't worry necessarily about that, but because they can now chain together different types of attacks very, very quickly. Anthropic announced last year they'd seen a significant incident involving what they say is a Chinese actor group. The Polish government published details earlier on this year, but the attack was in December, on what they say is a Russian-led attack by a group called Dragonfly against their electricity grid in December, itself also widely using AI. So this ecosystem is already challenging. Now it's getting much faster, much more dangerous.
I was going to ask about that, the next generation AI, because some of us like me, we're only getting to terms with what's out there at the moment. And now it seems to be advancing in a whole entirely different. I'm just wondering how we deal with any of these elements when it's rapidly increasing exponentially in what it can do.
Blind panic? No. So there's two things to keep in mind. One, since 2022, we've seen a dramatic increase in the use of, you know, the development of large language models, which are a particular type of AI technology. But I think the thing to keep in mind, that was already happening and was being introduced and used within cybersecurity, both in defense and attack, with great utility and effect in both sides. But on the 7th of April this year, the world changed and changed quite significantly. And when we look back 20 years from now, that's the date that people will point to. That's the date that Anthropic announced that not just that they had a model called Mythos, but that that model had proven to be extremely effective at finding vulnerabilities in software systems and had been widely deployed using a project they called Glasswing to detect and fix issues in widely deployed software systems like mobile phone iOS or operating systems, like you name it. So that's an incremental exchange point in all of this. The world changed on that day. The implications are huge, and I won't go into all of the details, but I think the material point for democracies is that we can't adapt on this in a five-year policy cycle. If it takes us a year to write a national cybersecurity strategy, and that's about what it takes, if it takes us 2 or 3 years to do legislation, that's too slow for a world that's changing this quickly. I would hope, with that degree of certainty, that the next national cybersecurity strategy will commit that we will iterate on this on a daily basis, that we will be changing all the time. All our advice, all our guidance, all our technical measures, all our assessment tools, all of our tools we use to detect, monitor, and respond to incidents live will have to take cognizance of AI, because otherwise we will lose. It's literally that fast. We published two documents today while we're on the subject on AI. One is an AI risk assessment for public sector use of AI, and one is guidance for public sector bodies using AI. These two documents are an example of that kind of iterative, very, very radical, very dramatic speed up of state response. Because if we're not doing this quickly, we're not doing this at all.
Maria Grazia, I chaired an event for ADAPT that was held. It was a national forum on AI that was held at William Fry. And one of the big discussions at it was about the balance between innovation and security and rights. And I wonder, given that Europe is trying to lead in the area with things like GDPR and the AI Act. I wonder, is Europe getting the balance right? And is it, you know, something that Ireland clearly is going to have to be wrestling with as well over the next 6 months?
Thanks, Patrick. This is a great question, a fundamental question. And there's three parts to the answer: past, present, and future. I think it's important to remember that the relationship between innovation, security, and rights is co-essential to the European Union. The European Union is a project based on the pooling of critical infrastructure to prevent conflict and the building of institutions to pursue values common to the member states, such as democracy and fundamental rights. And rightly, these are high up in Ireland's presidency program for the semester. It is a testament to the EU that it became a leader in digital technology, what's become known as the Brussels effect. But we shouldn't forget that, like any other field of regulation, history and geopolitics are always affecting this sort of outcome, the intended outcome. EU digital policy developed on the ashes of the Cold War and the depoliticization of technology. And according to this, it is for the law to identify the sort of high priorities. And then, as we heard from Ambassador Telemaco, the sort of technical details were left to the technical community and the market developing and designing the technology. And this process has always been international. It's involved international institutions such as the OECD, for instance, but also international standardization organizations. And that led to an interesting phenomenon we don't really think about, which is a mid-Atlantic compromise. Is this the best equilibrium? There's no such a thing as a best equilibrium, but in a relatively stable world with a strong civic society, we could always work on trying to improve this sort of mix, you know, this mid-Atlantic compromise. Today, however, we are facing dire challenges. We've heard about them. The minister talked about some of the challenges that we face. Johnny was talking about some of the challenges that we face. I think actually there's a lot of connection. It's the enforcement challenge because the world has become so complex. There's an enforcement for regulators, there's an enforcement for public institutions, there's an enforcement issues for SMEs, which are really struggling today, as we heard with the Draghi report. And we have the repoliticization of technology, which risks bringing with it beggar thy neighbor policies, which are the precursor to war. And that's very, very dangerous. So how do we move forward? Well, we need to start fixing the problems of this imperfect balance that we have today. Technology is built based on market logics. First to the market, for instance, not fundamental rights, certainly. You want to sort of scale up quickly so as to get, you know, as much take up as possible. And that has led, unfortunately, to technological monocultures. And that has damaged fundamental rights. Privacy and data protection are some of the ones that we focus on in the center, but also cybersecurity, because it's led to a market for lemons, which is a market failure, which requires regulatory intervention. So how do we deal with this? I think I'm going to borrow some of Anna Kokkinis-Prokopiou's points from her speech and also the motto for Irish presidency. I think that's really important. We want to stand united. Our strength comes from unity. We want to develop responsible, human-centered innovation, which is sustainable at the core. What we want to do is to make sure that we have distributed innovation across the geography of the EU. We don't want to leave anyone behind. And we need to make sure that we use regulation and our values not as an obstacle, but as a strength to, for instance, deliver on the promise of security and privacy by design, which is so crucial for really having transformative technology. And I think academia has got a role to play here. And this is the space where we hope to be contributing going forward.
Johnny, if you could change one aspect of European digital policy tomorrow, something that you think would have the greatest impact on our lives and well-being, what would you change?
Well, I'll answer that. But first, I want to pick up on this word you were using, Maria. We. Who's we? Ireland isn't part of we. Ireland wants big tech that is not European, that is US and Chinese, to remain big. Our model is to serve them well, to be the most hospitable environment for them. You're absolutely right to nod your head. If we wanted Irish indigenous innovators to scale, if we wanted to support German innovators to scale, we would be enforcing things like purpose limitation. And that would stop the internal free-for-all that allows massive incumbents to cascade their data power and dominate market after market. You can look at Europe's security problems, its problems with children's mental health, its problems of competitiveness, and find many causes. But there is one common one, and it's this country. So we are not we, and we should, at least to ourselves, recognize what we are doing. It is the same thing that we have been doing on tax. It's the same racket. That is going to become impossible to continue because the harmful consequences are not just impoverishing Europe and making it weaker, but we rely on a strong Europe because we ourselves are so weak. So all of the stuff we had with the Trump negotiation, that is a symptom of a bigger pattern that we have been contributing to. So I take issue with this idea of we and that we're all on the same voyage. We don't even admit what team we're on. We are on Mayfain team. That is Irish for me and not you. That is why in The Guardian this morning, I was recommending something that will not happen, that Ireland would know itself and would recuse itself because it is impossible for us to do the right thing. The Fiscal Advisory Council, which is part of the government apparatus, but is independent, noted in recent months that over half of our corporate tax came from three non-EU companies. Three. The last year for which we have data is 2022, and it shows that the corporate tax take per person in Ireland was five times higher than in Germany or France. I can't even imagine how much higher it would be than in Cyprus. Again, it's not we. So the one change would be that Brussels, that Tusk, Merz, Macron would finally decide we are not willing to let Ireland sell out the mental health of our children, sell out our innovators. We are going to clamp down on that member state. They probably shouldn't have done so after 2008. They need to do it now. And from Ireland's perspective, let's see how honest we are with ourselves in October when we have our AI event, because it probably will not look the way it ought to, is my suggestion.
Very good. Richard, I wonder, do you want to get in on that? And also,
Don't expect Richard to represent the state. He's busy protecting us all. I'm not having a go at him.
Very good. But Richard, any thoughts on that? But also, if you were to give any advice to the centre as they begin on the eve of the presidency, what do you think they should focus on, or where are the opportunities to make a significant contribution over the next 6 months?
So I won't respond to those, not because I don't want to, but because I can't, which is fairly straightforward. The second thing, what should the centre do? So, I mean, to go back for a second, the NCSC has been around for 15 years now. And one of the things we've been struggling with and working with for a long time is building a national competence across the full range of cybersecurity research and development functions. We are across multiple third-level institutions in Cork, in Limerick, in Galway, in various different parts of Dublin. There's third-level institutions with cybersecurity research capability. If you map that on a heat map, and we've gone and done it, you find that we're very strong in a couple of areas close to industry, but there's vast areas where we're not strong at all. I think the most important piece of this new centre is the fact that it's truly multidisciplinary, and you have law and human rights and related issues coming into it. There is a historian's perspective here and the link between culture and society, which I think will be utterly essential. But I mean, just to go back a second, I worked on what was the first Irish website, one of the first 10 websites in the world, as a history student in UCC many, many years ago. That's its interdisciplinary tools look like. People who invent things suit their purpose or invent it for the sake of the technology. And that's the thing I think this centre can bring. It is that multidisciplinary culture, society, law, human rights element that is missing from some of the others.
Anne-Marie Grazia, I'm going to leave the final word to you if you want to respond to any of the things.
Well, I think I'll start with the recommendations for the center, because that this is what we need. And I think I'm going to be able to bring both speeches in. Thank you very much for your invitation, and as well, you know, for pointing out that we are a multidisciplinary research center. This is what we hope to be our strength going forward. Some of the researchers that populate the center are covering topics that are mentioned in the program for the presidency. We go from regulatory coherence to the age of majority online, you know, safety issues, AI issues, maritime security, cryptography, you name it. And we include as well the history, culture, and society piece, which is fundamental to understand it all. So, you know, hopefully we're going to be able to leverage this as well as the fantastic research that is going on across Ireland, because I'd like to call out some of our colleagues that have traveled today from DCU, UCD, MTU, UL, you know, that are active in the space. And, you know, we hope to be able to, you know, leverage your good work as well to become one of the leading voices in this sphere and contribute to the challenges that we have. The second is also an aspiration, and I'd like to, unfortunately, the chair of the Oroctus AI committee has left, but he was talking about intellectual honesty. I liked that invitation. I do hope that we are going to make good use of what's unique about academia and especially important in the age of AI, which is academic freedom. We hope to be pursuing the search for truth, inspiring others to search for truth, and communicating difficult truths. And this is where it's great to actually be having debates where we have different voices, you know, we have different heads, has to think differently and that call out on different aspects, because it is precisely this conversation that is going to lead us to the outcomes that we need. A few years back, the European Court for Human Rights said that academia has an important role to play, that of watchdog, societal watchdog, which we share, for instance, with the civil society organizations. So we hope to be able to, you know, live up by that expectation and act as a watchdog in this space, because digital security and societal resilience entail quite some trade-offs and therefore a number of potential solutions, a number of potential outcomes. We hope to be able to identify the solutions and those potential outcomes and, you know, leave it to society and societal leaders to then choose the solutions that best serve society as we know it.
Okay, so that wraps up our episode on the launch of the new centre. Lots of food for thought. And thanks, Olivia Waters, for joining us today on Adapt Radio. Olivia, is there anything we should know about the centre? Is there anything coming up of interest in the next little while?
Thanks, Claire. Yeah, so this event actually kicked off what will be a series of events during Ireland's presidency of the European Council. We're going to have one around critical infrastructure. We're going to have one around the democratic resilience. And we're also going to have another one around the transatlantic bridge and, you know, our connection, Europe's connection with the US. So all the information will be available on the website, which is www.tcd.ie/digital-security-resilience.
Brilliant. We will put that website in the show notes as well. And if you would like to find out more about ADAPT's work in this area more generally, do visit the ADAPT website, www.adaptcentre.ie, and check out the show notes, where we will also highlight some previous episodes that dig into these topics. For now, though, until next time, from me, Dr. Claire O'Connell, slán, and thanks for listening.
The ADAPT Radio podcast is brought to you by the ADAPT Centre at Trinity College Dublin. Find out more about their extensive research work at adaptcentre.ie. Join us next time to hear about more groundbreaking innovations. To get new episodes automatically, just click the follow button on your player right now. The Adapt Radio podcast is produced by dustpod.io, with episodes monthly on Apple, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.